There was a strange look on the man's face, bewilderment, as if he had no conception of the issue confronting him, and fear, as if he had always had full knowledge of it, and had lived in dread of exposure. Reardon felt a strange excitement. He felt as if he were about to grasp something he had never understood, as if he were on the trail of some discovery still too distant to know, except that it had the most immense importance he had ever glimpsed. "Mr. Reardon," said the man, "the government needs your metal. You have to sell it to us, because surely you realize that the government's plans cannot be held up by the matter of your consent." "A sale," said Reardon slowly, "requires the seller's consent." He got up and walked to the window. "I'll tell you what you can do." He pointed to the siding where ingots of Reardon metal were being loaded onto freight cars. "There's Reardon metal. Drive down there with your trucks, like any other looter, but without his risk, because I won't shoot you, as you know I can't. Take as much of the metal as you wish and go. Don't try to send me payment. I won't accept it. Don't print out a check to me. It won't be cashed. If you want that metal, you have the guns to seize it. Go ahead." "Good God, Mr. Reardon, what would the public think?" It was an instinctive, involuntary cry. The muscles of Reardon's face moved briefly in a soundless laughter. Both of them had understood the implications of that cry. Reardon said evenly, in the grave, unstrained tone of finality, "You need my help to make it look like a sale, like a safe, just, moral transaction. I will not help you." The man did not argue. He rose to leave. He said only, "You will regret the stand you've taken, Mr. Reardon." "I don't think so," said Reardon. He knew that the incident was not ended. He knew also that the secrecy of Project X was not the main reason why these people feared to make the issue public. He knew that he felt an odd, joyous, light-hearted self-confidence. He knew that these were the right steps down the trail he had glimpsed. Dagny lay stretched in an armchair of her living room, her eyes closed. This day had been hard, but she knew that she would see Hank Reardon tonight. The thought of it was like a lever lifting the weight of hours of senseless ugliness away from her. She lay still, content to rest with the single purpose of waiting quietly for the sound of the key in the lock. He had not telephoned her, but she had heard that he was in New York today for a conference with producers of copper, and he never left the city till next morning, nor spent a night in New York that was not hers. She liked to wait for him. She needed a span of time as a bridge between her days and his nights. The hours ahead, like all her nights with him, would be added, she thought, to that savings account of one's life where moments of time are stored in the pride of having been lived. The only pride of her workday was not that it had been lived, but that it had been survived. It was wrong, she thought. It was viciously wrong that one should ever be forced to say that about any hour of one's life. But she could not think of it now. She was thinking of him, of the struggle she had watched through the months behind them, his struggle for deliverance. She had known that she could help him win, but must help him in every way except in words. She thought of the evening last winter when he came in, took a small package from his pocket and held it out to her, saying, "I want you to have it." She opened it and stared in incredulous bewilderment at a pendant made of a single pear-shaped ruby that spurted a violent fire on the white satin of the jeweler's box. It was a famous stone, which only a dozen men in the world could properly afford to purchase. He was not one of them. "Hank, why?"
"No special reason. I just wanted to see you wear it."
"Oh, no, not a thing of this kind. Why waste it? I go so rarely to occasions where one has to dress. When would I ever wear it?"
He looked at her, his glance moving slowly from her legs to her face. "I'll show you," he said. He led her to the bedroom. He took off her clothes, without a word, in the manner of an owner undressing a person whose consent is not required. He clasped the pendant on her shoulders. She stood naked, the stone between her breasts, like a sparkling drop of blood. Do you think a man should give jewelry to his mistress for any purpose but his own pleasure? He asked. This is the way I want you to wear it, only for me. I like to look at it. It's beautiful. She laughed. It was a soft, low, breathless sound. She could not speak or move, only nod silently in acceptance and obedience. She nodded several times, her hair swaying with the wide, circular movement of her head, then hanging still as she kept her head bowed to him. She dropped down on the bed. She lay stretched lazily, her head thrown back, her arms at her sides, palms pressed to the rough texture of the bedspread, one leg bent, the long line of the other extended across the dark blue linen of the spread, the stone glowing like a wound in the semi-darkness, throwing a star of rays against her skin. Her eyes were half closed in the mocking, conscious triumph of being admired, but her mouth was half open in helpless, begging expectation. He stood across the room looking at her flat stomach drawn in as her breath was drawn, at the sensitive body of a sensitive consciousness. He said, his voice low, intent, and oddly quiet, "Dagny, if some artist painted you as you are now, men would come to look at the painting to experience a moment that nothing could give them in their own lives. They would call it great art. They would not know the nature of what they felt, but the painting would show them everything. Even that you're not some classical Venus, but the vice president of a railroad, because that's part of it. Even what I am, because that's part of it too, Dagny. They'd feel it and go away and sleep with the first barmaid in sight, and they'd never try to reach what they had felt. I wouldn't want to seek it from a painting. I'd want it real. I'd take no pride in any hopeless longing. I wouldn't hold a stillborn aspiration. I'd want to have it, to make it, to live it. Do you understand?" "Oh, yes, Hank, I understand," she said. "Do you, my darling? Do you understand it fully?" she thought, but did not say it aloud. On the evening of a blizzard, she came home to find an enormous spread of tropical flowers standing in her living room against the dark glass of windows battered by snowflakes. They were stems of Hawaiian torch ginger, 3 feet tall. Their large heads were cones of petals that had the sensual texture of soft leather and the color of blood. "I saw them in a florist's window," he told her when he came that night. "I liked seeing them through a blizzard. But there's nothing as wasted as an object in a public window." She began to find flowers in her apartment at unpredictable times, flowers sent without a card, but with the signature of the sender, in their fantastic shapes, in the violent colors, in the extravagant cost. He brought her a gold necklace made of small hinged squares that formed a spread of solid gold to cover her neck and shoulders like the collar of a knight's armor. "Wear it with a black dress," he ordered. He brought her a set of glasses that were tall, slender blocks of square-cut crystal made by a famous jeweler. She watched the way he held one of the glasses when she served him a drink, as if the touch of the texture under his fingers, the taste of the drink, and the sight of her face were the single form of an indivisible moment of enjoyment. "I used to see things I liked," he said, "but I never bought them. There didn't seem to be much meaning in it. There is now." He telephoned her at the office one winter morning and said, not in the tone of an invitation, but in the tone of an executive's order, "We're going to have dinner together tonight. I want you to dress. Do you have any sort of blue evening gown? Wear it." The dress she wore was a slender tunic of dusty blue that gave her a look of unprotected simplicity, the look of a statue in the blue shadows of a garden under the summer sun. What he brought and put over her shoulders was a cape of blue fox that swallowed her from the curve of her chin to the tips of her sandals. "Hank, that's preposterous," she laughed. "It's not my kind of thing." "No?" he asked, drawing her to a mirror. The huge blanket of fur made her look like a child bundled for a snowstorm. The luxurious texture transformed the innocence of the awkward bundle into the elegance of a perversely intentional contrast, into a look of stressed sensuality. The fur was a soft brown, dimmed by an aura of blue that could not be seen, only felt like an enveloping mist. like a suggestion of color grasped, not by one's eyes, but by one's hands, as if one felt without contact the sensation of sinking one's palms into the fur's softness. The cape left nothing to be seen of her except the brown of her hair, the blue-gray of her eyes, the shape of her mouth. She turned to him, her smile startled and helpless.
I didn't know it would look like that.
I did.